Hello and welcome to the Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable football analytics podcast. My name is Michael Cayley. I'm coming to you on the Howler Radio Network, and this is, of course, an analytics podcast. We break down the football. We look at the football in all its component parts. We quantify the football. We analyze the football. We use technical terms and jargon to get at the tactics and what's going on in the football. And we have a theory for you that we're going to test out over the course of not just one, but two pods. I think the football might be coming home. That is my theory about the football based on my analytics. What do you think, Mike?
I think we need a ruling. Are we allowed to say football is coming home, or do we have to say football is going home?
It's funnier if you say coming home. I'm not sure why, but it scans better. So I think you have to say that.
We're not culturally appropriating the English if we do that? Okay. Fine. I, too, kind of think football might be coming home. Anyway, then we will get into this eventually. The music you heard on the way in is the Wailers. Max is with us on the other side of the virtual glass. Please download, subscribe, give us 5-star reviews. Make us happy as podcasters. Also, subscribe to our Patreon. Patreon.com/doublepivot, where we will be doing part 2 of this podcast this week as we break down all of the action that happened in the round of 16 before we get into the quarterfinals. So, where do we want to start? Start on the hard side of the bracket, and then we'll eventually get to the easier side.
And work our way over. I think that makes sense. So, just go chronologically and roll from there.
That works for me.
We start chronologically. It starts in a fun place.
Yes, it does.
So, I only watched France-Argentina on tape after knowing what had happened, because I was out petitioning all day. But it was I have a lot of takes on this. I'm not even really sure where to start with this game. I guess you start with what Argentina is set up to do.
So I'm gonna start with a question for you then, which is, this game ended 4-3. A lot of goals. Did this match make you either reconsider France's defensive robustness or Argentina's anemic attack?
On the first, basically no.
I agree.
On the second, it wasn't bad from Argentina. The problem was more that what they had to sacrifice in order to attack like that was a lot.
I mean, it wasn't bad considering they were playing France.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say. But, I mean, still, some of those goals, we could go through it, but the Di Maria goal that opened it up was like, you know, like, sometimes you hit them from 35 yards and they go in.
The goals in this game were stupid. Some of them were fantastic, but like the Di Maria goal, the Pavard goal was even stupider than the Di Maria goal. The was it Rojo? Who got the deflection off of Messi's shot? Was it Rojo again? Or anyway, somebody.
It was
the deflected goal.
It was a deflected goal.
But I wanted to sort of like go back over to what how Argentina set up for this game, because they came out in basically a 4-3-3 with Messi as the central striker, therefore as the false nine. It's Messi, like, dropping in. The thing was, though, that it was Messi flanked not by two wingers who really want to get – not like true inverted wingers who want to get into the box and score using the space that Messi opens up. He was not flanked by, like, Sadio Mane and – Sadio Mane and Mo Salah. He was flanked by Pavone and Di Maria, who both really wanted to stay wide. Yeah. And so you got this really weird system where, and the American announcers, actually, the Fox announcers were on this from the start, that like the French center backs were just sitting there. What are we doing? Because Messi would drop in to pick up the ball. The wingers would stay wide. and they would wait for someone to make a run into their area, and they'd be able to deal with it. It was, my dog is just as unhappy with Argentina's tactics as everyone else.
So usually in a situation like that, the point is to exploit the center backs, right? The point is that when Messi comes deep, the center backs are supposed to have a difficult decision as to whether or not to follow Messi deep or to pass him off with the midfielders. And if they were to follow Messi deep, the point is that somebody else makes runs into that space. But neither thing really happened for Argentina. Neither had people running into the space where Messi vacated, nor did you have Messi really able to do anything dangerous when he came deep and got the ball free, because the midfielders would just drop onto him, and Argentina's midfielders then wouldn't in turn make them pay.
Ever Banega is the most attacking of this midfield three. He isn't going to, make a run into the empty space in the 18-yard box. That's not what Nega does. He's a passer. And the other two guys are just, goons.
Less than that. Despite that, they scored three goals. And it was Mercado, by the way, who got the deflection on Messi's shot. Because Rojo was already out of the match by that point, having been subbed off at halftime for Federico Fazio.
Yeah, basically, as far as I could tell, Rojo is perfectly fine in the air, so I don't think it was to get the aerial threat. It was just to, have another center back who could kick some people.
So, this is the other part of that match, right? Which is, because none of that was working, and because France were then intermittently ahead, and then eventually ahead for good, Argentina just needed to do something, and what that something was fly around aggressively defensively. And they played an extraordinarily high line, which just played into France's hands.
Yeah, because the other part of this, they're playing this high line, and they are actually getting the fullbacks forward. So the fullbacks are getting forward, and they've got wingers. They're wildly overloading the wings. And they did get down. They got in 21 crosses on the game. They got a bunch of corners. They had a lot of crossing opportunities and no center forward to cross to. But then what that meant was that once they lost the ball, it was either that Enzo and Mascherano were going to stop the counterattack through the center, or they were massively outnumbered in the center because the wingers had stayed wide and the fullbacks had gotten high, and there just weren't that many numbers to stop the French counter. They basically sort of funneled France into playing a counterattacking style through Pogba and Mbappe. Their tactics
created
that. And then Pogba kept finding Mbappe, and Mbappe kept running, and Mbappe had an incredible game. Not to take anything away from how much fun it was to watch him, but Argentina kind of forced them to play that way with the way they lined up.
Look, and there are a lot of forwards who, if they were forced to inhabit Mbappe's role, would be constrained. There are a lot of good forwards who, if forced to inhabit, you could imagine a forward like Harry Kane or Robert Lewandowski struggling in that situation. They maybe wouldn't, because Mbappe, yes, he was nominally a winger, but he wasn't playing as a winger. He was very tucked in. Defensively, sometimes he would push out wide as they were overloading the wings, but in possession, he was frequently central.
Yeah, he played kind of a quasi-10, really.
Yes, but in a way, in the way in which Argentina were playing, which gave him lots of space to pick up the ball, turn, and run at a back line, which was just a disaster for Argentina.
I do think that, I had France about 1.6 expected goals, and based on the shots and chances they created, I think that seems about right. The only really clear shooting chances they created were, Mbappe getting pulled down for the penalty and the late goal for Mbappe. But there were a whole bunch. It was reminiscent in some ways of the Mexico match against Germany, that there were a whole bunch of good counterattacking opportunities that didn't turn in two shots and high quality chances because there was a last minute tackle or a last pass that didn't go through. It could have easily been a lot more for Argentina.
Yeah, that's
for France.
So we say goodbye to, we say goodbye to Argentina, who never looked like being particularly threatening in this tournament, even though they squeaked through. You know, it's weird because we looked at this match and we said about this match, well, the way Argentina could in theory win is if it's a horrible, ugly 1-0 something. And, you know, the match ended 4-3, but I feel like that was a little bit of a factor of circumstance, you know? Like, I feel like there wasn't that much space between this being the 4-3 it was and a weird, ugly 1-0 kind of a match.
Yeah, I mean, I felt it honestly, like, watching the first, like, 50 minutes or so, like, I knew exactly right. What was going to happen. I knew when the goals, I'd like, watch the highlights, because, like, you got to see the highlights.
Right.
And I still thought that France should have been up 2-0 and 3-0 and just walking away with the game at that point, before Argentina got their
goals.
Yeah,
I mean, well, so I think that obviously, the early goal, right, the early foul and goal changes the complexion
of
this
match. Yeah, that's fair.
Because I mean, now the question is, do you want to attribute Mbappe getting free for that first penalty to the same factors that later France exploited over and over and over again? And I'm not, like, entirely sure whether we should do that or not, but I mean, I think it's sort of an interesting academic question at least, right? Whereas, like, was France bound to do this to them from the jump, or was there a little bit of happenstance with them scoring early, which sort of pried the game open? I don't know.
I tend more toward thinking that this was, like, Argentina set up this way to allow them to counterattack through the middle, but it certainly, I agree, the opportunities expanded once Argentina really had to commit. That's when the fullbacks started to really get forward.
Right, exactly. All right, I don't have anything else interesting to say about this match other than, oh my gosh, Mbappe is awesome. We don't expect, like, France against, in the next round to be super expansive in any way, right? Because they weren't, like, super expansive here. They just had the opportunity to counterattack.
Right, Uruguay is not going to make any of the mistakes that Argentina made in setting up their squad. They might even have their manager set up the squad rather than have, like, Suarez do it. I don't know.
That would be, you know. We should talk about this because it becomes a thing about, like, Messi. Can Messi fail or can Messi only be failed? Like, if you want to say Sampaoli was a mess and a poor fit for this squad, I have, like, said this. I've written this. I agree with that. But it's not like Messi's tactics here, if these are Messi's tactics, make any sense whatsoever.
Either. No, like, Messi, I don't know if he gave himself this role. Maybe Sampaoli's still in charge and these are all just rumors that I super believe the rumors, but they are rumors. They are not, you know, accepted facts, you know, attested to by lots of people. This role was even more than usual an impossible role for Messi, because he was supposed to drop in and connect the defense and attack, but instead of having to connect the defense and attack for himself and one other striker, he had to do it for himself, and that's it. Or he could send it wide, and they could, like, cross into him, and he's very good at heading the ball, but he's be playing against two center backs, and he's tiny, and...
You know, it's a shame that Argentina didn't have, like, attacking players who can attack the box from wide areas with the ball at their feet and either create for themselves or others, who Messi could have dropped deep and then fed the ball to if they started. You know, if they had a player like Paulo Dybala, maybe things would have turned out differently, you know?
I love that Dybala and Lo Celso played, I think Dybala played, what, like 15 minutes total, and Lo Celso didn't get a single minute?
Yeah, something like that.
Like, what, I mean, I don't know if, like, Messi alone was in charge of this team, but the playing time certainly looked like someone was in charge of this team who didn't want to play the young guys, who wanted to play all the old established players. It looked like sort of the veterans of the clubhouse choosing who was going to be in there, whether that was because that was how Sampaoli wanted to or had to do it, or because it was the veterans of the clubhouse choosing it. But Dybala, like Lo Celso is obviously better than Enzo at literally everything.
Yeah.
And Dybala, as you said, fits this team perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly would have fit the team that they ran out against France absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
But what can you do? All right, we should move on because we have more games to talk about. And despite the fact that maybe Uruguay and Portugal weren't particularly interesting, they're worth talking about because Uruguay just keeps doing their
thing. Yeah, I mean, just yet another game won by the clutch shooting of Edinson Cavani. Game after game after game in important matches, Edinson Cavani shows up and makes it happen.
Look, Cavani, what's wonderful about this is that, say what you want about him at a club level, for country, he has spent a decade now doing dirty work for this team. Like, starting when Diego Forlan was still there, and Suarez and Forlan played up top, and he played as just a left winger, like, while he was becoming a breakout star at Napoli, right? Like, he has done work for this team for a generation for them. And then, like, at this World Cup, you see people breaking out stats about how few goals he scored and turning around and saying, like, pretending as if he was the striker for this team who struggled to score goals, as opposed to a guy who had sacrificed his position and his productivity for the team. So I really, like, I am incredibly happy. Of course, now he may be hurt. But I am incredibly happy he had this.
Yeah, I had a stat in qualifying and in friendly track by Opta since the last World Cup. Cavani had about three times more touches outside the final third than Suarez did in Uruguay matches. And this is, you know, it's a ratio, so this is adjusting for the matches Suarez missed for his bans and stuff. And this is how the first goal happened too, was that Cavani manages to get the ball back on the wing. He drops deep to get the ball. He swings a long ball into Suarez, but then he makes this run behind the Portuguese defense, and none of the Portuguese defenders appear to know he's doing it. He's just like sort of like creeping. You can see him like creeping in, like very carefully, and no one saw him. He manages to break off the shoulder of the last defender and have a clear chance on goals. Suarez's cross was also perfect. But it was Cavani creating for Suarez, creating for Cavani, which is how Uruguay's attack has to work. It doesn't work if they don't do that.
Well, except for the second goal, in which, I mean, Cavani broke through, and when, again, it was created for him. Which is just, it is a rarity, is the thing. Like, that's really what it comes to. It is a rarity. And in this case, it was Betancourt who slid a through ball into Cavani, put him in on goal. And I think we've made fun a little bit of the idea that Uruguay are going to be this progressive team with passers in midfield, because they still aren't at all. But having the ability of Betancourt there to play that ball is important.
Yeah, they're not going to change themselves stylistically. We saw this in this game. The moment they got that first Cavani goal, like they it's not like they were like attacking the game and seizing it by the throat beforehand. Once they got the goal, it was like, okay, we're going to defend now. We're done. And they closed up shop really well. Portugal got off a lot of shots, most of them outside the box or wide in the box. Almost none of them clear chances. None of them clear chances. It was a classic Uruguay performance, especially where if you get the first goal and you've got strikers who are good enough to get you that first goal, the whole team knows how to do the job once that happens.
I think it is probably fair to say they set up their midfield a little bit differently, right? Like, they have traditionally played a flat four, and this was very diamondy and very narrow. And it was perfect for the moment, and it worked. But it is, it, like, it... it if we're going to make fun of them for doing the Uruguay thing over and over and over again, we should at least concede that that is a wrinkle, I suppose.
I think that's definitely correct. I don't mean to say that Uruguay's thing is like fake or cheap. It's just that it's stylistic rather than like there are certainly many different ways for them to do what they do. But the style remains the same. And in this game,
right.
Facing a Portugal team that their best wide player Guedes kept playing in a two at the top, and then they're just like everyone else is cutting in. It like playing so narrow made perfect sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to the degree that we're making fun of them, it's because they said before the tournament that they weren't going to do this, and then they have proceeded to do this. I mean, that said, like Portugal did come back and draw the game on a Pepe header. Pepe and his glorious full set of hair.
I swear, I saw him and I was like, he's been in Portugal playing football. I haven't really watched. I was like, I swear to God, Pepe was bald. What's wrong? Am I going crazy?
Yeah, no, you didn't make that up. No, you are not. It is, you know, he is the most recent in a long line of players, including Diego Simeone and Wayne Rooney that have all of a sudden reappeared with hair. There's nothing interesting about the goal, right? It's just a header from
double pivot all-star Rafael Guerrero, who
that is true. That is to the extent that there's anything interesting, it is because we like Rafael Guerrero.
It'd be really nice if he could be like healthy for a while.
It would be. And, like, have a consistent position. Like, you can just play him at left back for a while. It's okay. You don't have to, like, mess around with
him. Yeah, let him be a really good passing left back rather than try to solve other problems.
Right. I can make my pitch that he's just the next Marcelo, but we don't have to do that now. We can, like, do that over the course of the next three club seasons. And then Cavani puts the game away on the through ball from Betancourt, where again he opens up his body and takes a brilliant shot. Before we move on, the thing I want to ask is, like, it feels like Uruguay won this comfortably. They also took a grand total of 5 shots. Like, 5 shots. And I know that a lot of that is because they scored in the 7th minute. So, right, then we pack it in and we protect the lead, and this is what we do, and we're really good at it. They still have Cavani and Suarez up top. Shouldn't they have, like, some more of a potent counterattack possibility than 5 shots over the course of this game?
I mean, but if you look at the way they set up, like, Betancourt, and he made that one great pass, but he's their most advanced midfielder in this system. And their fullbacks are not built to get forward at all. I mean,
no, not at all.
So there's
not at all.
Really, it's an incredibly broken team they were playing. It's really like there are 7 players. There are 8 players back and 2 ahead.
But like, this is a problem, right? Like we can both praise how good they are at doing the thing they do and recognize that, like, that's an extreme tightrope you are creating.
Exactly. This team is not built in any particular way to come back once they go down.
But they're also, but they're not even built to, like, extend the lead.
They will win. They won 2-0, so nice job. But as you said, scoring 2 of their 5 shots. They are built to win 1-0.
Yeah. Yes. Or go to penalties. Like that, I mean, and so, you know, now we come to Uruguay versus France, and like, I feel like we've said this a lot and thankfully been disproven a lot. Like, how is this game going to be any fun?
Yeah, because I was saying that Argentina-France wasn't going to be any fun, but that was me assuming that Argentina wouldn't, like, overload the wings and attack, which, and silly me, I thought that would be a bad idea, so they wouldn't do it. Uruguay's not going to make those mistakes. Uruguay's going to play a team, I would guess they'll probably put on, they'll probably try to be a little bit wider because France actually have wingers, but the style is going to be the same. And we've seen France try to break down not very good opposition defenses and occasionally have some trouble with it. Like, this seems like a game that's just going to be played in Uruguay's offensive half. And yeah, that's kind of how they like it.
But also, France aren't going to take risks either. Right? Like, this is a game that, yes, France is going to play it in Uruguay's half, but they're going to play it with however they line up. You know, but probably the combination of Giroud, Griezmann, and Mbappe in some capacity being tasked with doing all the attacking. Like, right, you're not going to see them start to extend themselves to score against Uruguay. You're not going to see Pogba come and get up to the edge of the 18 and mix, you know, and combine an attack, I don't think. You're not going to see the fullbacks overlap deep into the corner. And so you're left with three very good attacking players without much support, trying to break down a very good defense. And that to me seems like, you know, maybe something happens. Maybe there's a set piece. Maybe there's a weird counter or whatever. But, like, I struggle to see how this game would ever be open.
I think that's probably right. It is interesting because Blaise Matuidi is going to be on a yellow card suspension. So they can't play their preferred, like, most defensive midfielder sort of like pair with Pogba ahead of Conte. But we saw them try Tolisso and that ended up sort of messing up who was on the ball in the right times. They could try Lamar and like a, I think this is a perfect game for them to switch their system up a little bit. But it's Didier Deschamps, and so they will not. But it's interesting because he's probably not going to go back to Tolisso either because that was so not working. I don't know what he's going to do. I assume it's going to be bad and boring, but I don't know specifically what it's going to be.
It would not surprise me at all if it was in Zanzi. At all. Like if it wasn't so Uruguay, I would predict it. If it was a slightly more attacking team, it had Portugal won, I would have said it'll just be Nzonzi, and that's how they'll do it. Given that Uruguay is so conservative, maybe Tolisso gets another shot or Lamar gets a shot. It's possible. But, like, I would not be at all surprised if they just leave. He's just like, oh, yeah, I'll just throw out the other defensive midfielder.
Zanzi at DM and free Conte to do lots of stuff. That'll be a fun thing to watch if Conte is, like, really free in, like, an eight position.
The problem is, like, if you have 70% of the ball, free Conte isn't doing much. Like, you have the ball back. Yeah, now
this is what happened with Chelsea a bunch of times in the last like 2 years, is that Conte would set them up in such a defensive shape that it was N'Golo Conte whose job it was to make those runs into the penalty area. And he actually wasn't bad at it. He was certainly better than Bakayoko, who occasionally had that job, and that was highly unpleasant to watch. But like, it is a bizarre way to set yourself up that you need N'Golo Kanté to be making attacking runs into the penalty area. And it seems not unlikely that's what they'll be doing.
Right, exactly. All right, should we move to the bottom half of the bracket?
Let's drop down. The bottom half of the hard bracket. So, Brazil seem okay.
Yeah, they seem pretty good. They handled Mexico.
I thought Mexico played well against them.
Mexico's This is the thing. Mexico, I thought, played pretty well, and still were not particularly close to Brazil, in my estimation. And that is a testament to Brazil.
No. Brazil kept... They stuck with what they've been doing. And they also, I thought this was... One thing I thought was interesting, because I have been like, I'm not sure William's the guy for this team. I'm not sure William's the guy for this team, especially if they mean to be attacking. And William had a fantastic game. Neymar ends up man of the match because he gets the late assist as well as the goal. But William created the first goal, and during that early period of pressure, which was basically Mexico sending Vela at Fagner, that was pretty much their and they also sort of the fullback got up against Wagner's side. Guardado seemed to be getting down that wing as well. Like, they seemed to have a very specific strategy of attacking Brazil's right fullback. And then Willian was like, oh, I guess I'm going to go back and defend. And then it was over. Willian just tracked back and cleared that up, and it wasn't an issue for the rest of the game. Brazil seemed to sort of lose... Mexico seemed to sort of just lose enough energy that they couldn't counter-press. And so if they weren't either attacking the right fullback or counter-pressing and creating things and stopping Brazil from transitioning, they had nothing left. And after about 30 minutes, it was... The first 30 minutes, Mexico were good. They had a couple of ideas. Then Brazil solved those problems, and that was it.
Yeah, I thought Mexico played well, but Mexico also sort of evinced the problem that we've seen from them in the lead up, which is that they have over the last couple of years under Juan Carlos Osorio, they've had trouble turning possession into good shots. They've been able to play good build up stuff. They're comfortable interchanging positions. They are good at attacking. They want to attack, moving the ball side to side, getting it where they want to get it. And then in the final third, that does not turn into good shots. And they had 14 shots here, and exactly one was on target. Half of them were from outside the penalty area. There were no big chances. Like, this was a Mexico attack that suffered from all of the problems that like, you worried coming into the tournament that Mexico might have. I think some of this needs to go to credit to Brazil. Because early on, they did an excellent job of, despite almost getting broken down, having bodies back and well-positioned in their own penalty area. So that when Wagner got attacked, he wasn't out on an island. And there was always another body coming. But since the attack was get it to the isolated wing, have them beat the fullback, and that's the plan, when you ran a second body at them, that ended the attack. And so, like, Brazil's defense was good. Like, they had a weakness exploited, they corrected for it, and even while that weakness was exploited, there was cover. And then Brazil were good in attack again. Like, they know how to play this system. They know how to get Neymar and Coutinho overlapping in the same area to create space for the two of them because they are both so dangerous. William struggled in the group stage, as a complimentary passer. He did not here. And part of that, I think, again, is that William is a very good counter-attacking passer and a very good counter-attacking mover, but not a particularly athletic counterattacker. So if he has space, he can make stuff happen, but he needs a little bit more space to quote unquote have space. And he had that against Mexico. It was obviously his movement that set up Neymar's goal. And then Firmino comes on late to add the second for the Neymar assist. And the thing that I do want to raise here is Firmino's been great this tournament coming off the bench. This was his third substitute appearance in four games. Brazil have looked dangerous every time he's on the field. Gabriel Jesus has not scored in this tournament. Like, Is that a thing? Should that be a thing? Like, are Brazil better if Firmino were to start instead of Jesus?
And it's not that Jesus has been, like, missing lots of good chances. He's getting on the end of far fewer chances so far than he did in the league season. And then he did in qualifying, where his XG is fantastic, like it is for City.
He's gotten on the end of very high quality shots, but not very many of them.
So I'm not really sure if this means they need to, like, have a different striker. Like, Firmino's so good, like, you know, it's not the craziest idea to just, like, ride the hot hand. But it's not obvious to me that Jesus is the problem. The one thing I took away from this game, for those first 30 minutes when Mexico were doing well, one thing that they were able to do was, by counter-pressing, force Casemiro and Paulinho to be on the ball and making the key passes. Paulinho or Casemiro, and as Marcelo was out, one of the fullbacks, had to be the people breaking the counter-press and trying to make that incisive pass that starts the counter, and then that frees Willian or Neymar or Coutinho to be running in space. And for the first 30 minutes or so, that was working because the Casemiro and Paulinho were not driving the ball forward, because that's not what they do, and they were under pressure, making it that much harder for them to do it. And I am interested in what a team that could try to counter-press Brazil for 90 minutes might be able to do against a midfield where Coutinho, I mean, Coutinho's playing midfield, but he's getting up high. He wants to be receiving the ball in a pretty advanced position on those counters. It is Casemiro and Paulinho who are much deeper. And if, depending on Marcelo's health, if the fullbacks are not great passers either, that seems like a possible weakness more to me.
And it's also worth noting that Casemiro is going to be suspended. He's on a yellow card suspension for the next match, which does create issues. You know, but all that said, like, Brazil still took 20 shots and created three big chances and won 2-0.
Yeah, and then they were doing the same thing. They were getting down that wing. They were breaking down inside the penalty area, looking for that easy cutback that creates the huge chance. A bunch of them didn't come off. Two came off. Tons of XG, two goals, easy.
Yeah, this is the thing with Brazil is you can critique how they're playing to a certain degree, and it's because they have a very high ceiling, I think, and because they have so much talent that there's always this feeling that, like, oh, they won 2-0 and didn't score for the first 50 minutes, they could have played better, which is, like, true as far as it goes, but they also played, like, significantly better than Mexico, who was the opponent in front of them. Like, they've played very, very well this tournament. And it's one of those things where if you took the names off the jerseys, or you took the, you know, you changed the Brazilian color scheme and you watched them play, or just looked at their numbers, either way, like, in both directions, you would look at a team and be like, oh, this team's really good. But because they're Brazil, they could play this level of soccer the entire tournament and win the tournament, perhaps without getting deeply tested. And you'd still just, and there would still be a temptation to be like, well, yeah, but they didn't play that well.
Yeah, I'm much more like searching for a thing to say about Brazil that is a weakness than saying there's anything wrong with what Brazil did.
Yeah. Yeah, but, like, there is this belief, I think, that they do, that they are generally not that strong. And I'm just not sure, like,
it's weird.
I'm not sure I'm not sure where it comes from. I'm not sure, like, what people expect to be seeing. I mean, I think some of it is the Neymar thing. I think some people are just not going to like how Neymar plays. And that's why there's, I think, this sort of somewhat of a belief that, like, Firmino, if he came in, would make them better. But, like, how much better do you want them to be?
They're not struggling to create chances. They're certainly not seeing other teams create good chances against them. They're fun to watch. Like, it's not like this is, like, stultifying 1-0 Uruguay football. They can do stuff in possession when they've got dribblers and passers in possession. They have been extremely dangerous on the counterattack. Like, the level at which, like, you'd be disappointed, I mean, maybe it's just that people, in order to be entertained by Brazil, they need to see something new every time, rather than seeing, like, good attacking football and smart, efficient counterattacks with lots of good movement and like, do these guys need to be just doing sombreros every 10 minutes to be exciting? They're really fun to watch!
Yeah, you know what it reminds me of a little bit? It reminds me a little bit of the Jose Mourinho Real Madrid sides, which, like, played often open, expansive, ruthless football, while also being structurally sound defensively. But Mourinho had this reputation, and in big games, they would nail it down. And then so the reputation of Madrid was that they weren't fun. But if you watch them for, like, 20 minutes against, like, 90% of opponents, they were, like, cutting into space, and, you know, Ronaldo was in full flight down the sideline, and, like, they were entertaining. And I feel that same sort of disconnect here.
Yeah, I mean, we said they were the best team before the World Cup. Their statistics before the World Cup were clearly the best in the world. And they have done absolutely nothing that would make you, like, second-guess that judgment. That's just where we are.
I mean, they drew against Switzerland, I guess.
Yeah. So they've won three games and drawn one.
And it took them a long time to score against Costa Rica, even though they were beating the snot out of Costa Rica.
Yeah, so they were beating the snot out of Costa Rica. I mean, what's interesting here, though, is that they are going, if they do win this World Cup, no one's going to doubt it at the end of it. Because they're going to get Belgium, and then they're going to get France, or they're going to get a Uruguay team that beat France.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's true. I sort of feel like if they beat Belgium, beat Uruguay, and beat whoever comes out of the easy side of the bracket, you're going to have people say, well, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that's true. If France have to win, I mean, to make that semi, really. Sane.
Yes. I think that's right. All right. Should we bop down to Japan and Belgium here?
Yeah, that game was crazy. I watched it at an Argentinian bar near my house. So I've been watching a lot of games, and I should, like, mention them. It's Cafe Argentino. You should go there. Their food is great, and they keep being really nice to me and letting me, like, collect petitions for 2 hours.
Well, as long as we're doing plugs, we should probably talk about the people that pay us, and that is, of course, The Athletic. You guys know what this is. You guys know what Athletic Soccer is. Both Kelly and I write there from time to time. You get a subscription. You get good, high-quality sports journalism. They don't do clickbait. They don't go after, you know, quick sort of gimmicky pieces. The entire point is that you get quality for what you pay for. And so we've been doing a ton of World Cup coverage over there.
And
I was going to say, we have the power rankings that Adam Snavely does on a regular basis, sort of throughout the World Cup, just sort of checking in with all of your favorite teams to see exactly how worried you should be about them. You know, Nick Dorrington, who is a South American soccer expert, wrote a little bit about the Argentinian chaos to come. You know, he looked at this generation of players who are now on their way out, and then talked about sort of what's next for Argentina, which is a little bit ugly. One of my favorite writers, who also writes for me at StatsBomb, Mohamed, wrote a thing about England set pieces, which you should all go and read, and is totally excellent, and talks a whole bunch about the NBA as well. This is like high quality, interesting stuff. And we like The Athletic. We vouch for it. We write for it. We think you will enjoy it should you subscribe to it.
Yeah, it's so good that like people shouldn't need like a special deal to go get it. And yet there's a special deal. Because if you go to theathletic.com/doublepivot, you can get 40% off a year subscription. So that seems like a good thing to read these great pieces by a friend of the pod, Mo Squared, by Nick Dorrington, and by us probably soon. So we recommend it. We like working there. You probably like writing it.
I want to add one more piece, because we've talked about Matt Pizdowski a couple of times as we've gone. And as we get into shootout time in the World Cup, it is incredibly handy to have a goalkeeper writing about the battles that go on, the subtle battles of penalty taking and the art of goalkeeping during a shootout. You should subscribe to The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/doublepivot.
All right. Well, I think that is an important plug that we wanted to do. But continuing my plug for Cafe Argentino,
this is advanced podcasting. We're sandwiching one plug inside another plug. It's the Mariah Gadals of ads here.
Yeah, we successfully let me just like set up a table and like collect petitions from candidates for 2 hours, just like people coming in and out the door and buying nothing. And they're lovely and wonderful, and their food is fantastic. And then watching this game, I was talking to a woman who is sitting near me, who she's Argentinian, and she's of her family is of Japanese extraction, and so like she was like, ah, the game was really tough with Argentina, but this one, we'll see how it goes. And then Japan kind of ended up doing the same thing that Argentina did, where because the goals were so good, even though the team wasn't playing that well, they got into this position where it was like, oh my God, they're going to win. They're going to do it. This is so exciting. And then they didn't. I felt bad for her is basically my point. But
so I think we should break this into two parts. Because I didn't think Belgium played particularly well, but I think this is an interesting tension here, where you're completely right. Japan created very little and scored two really excellent but unlikely goals. But at the same time, both of those goals came from tactical issues that we knew Belgium had. You know, they scored a wonder goal from 25 yards. There was also not a midfielder in sight as they lined it up and scored it. Both of those things are true at the same time, right? That, like, the goal was unlikely, but it was also a part of the reason it happened was this problem where Belgium doesn't really have a midfield as such.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this was my thing going into this game, is that I wanted to see a team that really could counterattack in a way that would give Belgium trouble for not having a midfield and having a fake wing back. And Japan probably weren't it. And then Japan didn't create that much in their counterattack, but their shooting was so good that it made it work. The thing that I would give Belgium credit for, though, is I thought that their pressure on the Japanese penalty area was eventually pretty much overwhelming.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they piled forward. They took a ton of shots. Obviously, the goal that won them the game was just such a ridiculous counterattack. I mean, just so good. And the first goal from Vertonghen was absurd. This looping angled header, which you're not going to see any goals like that. And then goal number two was just Fellaini doing Fellaini things. So, like, the third goal was a great chance, but it was a very unique situation. The first two goals were not high quality necessarily shots, but the fact that those were the two that ended up going in obscures the fact that there were a lot of really good chances created. But not really, they created those chances after they went down. And they piled forward chasing the match. It's not like for the first hour, or the first half, they were particularly dominant in attack.
No. It was only after they started pushing for the game that they were able, and for the most part, what they were doing was like really getting down the wings and getting balls into Lukaku's head. The best two chances that they didn't score were Lukaku headers. But Lukaku had an excellent game getting on the end of those headers and then making this brilliant run, not touching the ball once on that last counterattack, but pulling a defender out of, first pulling the defender out of the way of Meunier, and then holding on to that defender and giving Chadli space to make his run past the penalty spot and dummying the ball to Chadli. It was really spectacular. You can watch it over and over and like see him like manipulating the whole field. It's a lot
watching
of fun.
It from tactical cam is pretty revelatory. Watching the way he bends his run to first pick up one fullback to free the right flank of the attack, and then to dart back across and pick up the other wide defender, who I'm not sure who it was, and I don't think it was a fullback, and suck him into the middle, pull him off Chadli, and then dummy the ball so that Chadli is in on goal. It's just such a brilliant work, you know, piece of attacking play. Did we learn anything that we didn't know about Belgium from this match?
I don't think so. What I was just thinking about right now is that, have we ever seen this Belgium team in a high-stakes game against a team that is better than them and they know is better than them? Like, this Brazil match...
I don't think so.
I don't think we've seen... Are they just going to go out there with Ferreira Carrasco at wingback and just, like, fly at them? Are they going to try to sit back?
I've got a lot of experience with Bobby Martinez, and I do not think he is telling this team to play conservatively. I think that Bobby Martinez has two modes, and that is dominate the ball and fail to dominate the ball.
That seems right, and they seem unlikely. You know, if they wanted to dominate the ball, maybe they'd play like one of the best controlling central midfielders in the world. But instead, that he's going to sit on the bench, and Witzel and De Bruyne are going to play. So,
look, I mean, it is quite clear that they should, you know, probably not play Dries Mertens, push De Bruyne forward, and play two actual center midfielders. I think I'd probably play Dembele and Fellaini. I guess you could make an argument for Dembele and Witzel, but like, if you're gonna play this weird three center back system, that's what you should do.
You don't need a dedicated defensive midfielder in this system. You've got three center backs and
right,
and then
but like.
If you want to have the ball, you should have Moussa Dembélé play, because no one is better at getting and keeping the ball than Moussa Dembélé.
Especially arrested Moussa Dembélé, who's barely played this tournament.
Yeah, I
don't know. I don't know what we're going to do, what Brazil's really going to do for this midfield either, though, is the thing, because they don't have Casemiro. Are they just going to move Fernandinho in, and then they're just going to play Fernandinho, Paulinho, and Coutinho as a midfield three? I mean, that seems reasonable, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, that's what I assumed. It changes them a little bit. Fernandinho definitely likes to move out of that central midfield a little bit more. But, you know, that's why you play Paulinho. He also likes to move that midfield, but he will run around and cover. If you need a little bit more defending, that should be just fine. To me, that Brazil change seems like something they're going to manage pretty easily.
Yeah, I mean, And I don't expect Belgium to change. I really don't. Like, I would be surprised if it wasn't Yannick Varesco at left wing back and De Bruyne and Witzel in midfield. I don't know how that plays against Brazil. I don't, like, it just feels like Brazil's going to sit there and just absorb hits and ping them on the counterattack all day and rip them apart. Like,
yeah,
I
it's like getting found out, but instead of getting found out by Wales, where it's like a close game and it's kind of exciting, it's just a stomping.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I you look for ways for Belgium to be competitive, and they have tons of talent. And like, look, Hazard against whoever, whether it's Wagner, whether it's Danilo at right back, and even like if Marcel is not healthy at left back, like Belgium have legitimate attacking advantages, you know, on the wings against Brazil's fullbacks. But they're not going to play in a way to like suck Brazil in and expose those fullbacks. They're going to play in a way where they want to have the ball. And so what my concern would be is that basically the game gets scattered. And if the game gets scattered and Belgium can't like attempt to pick off Brazil's fullbacks and instead it's just going up and down the field, Brazil is just going to, I mean, Brazil just have, they're too cohesive in that moment. Brazil's cohesiveness will hang together much more than Belgium's will.
Yeah, I just have trouble seeing how, you know, Belgium's got enough talent to make this happen, but you look at the teams they're going to put on the field, the way they're going to play, it just seems like Brazil is probably going to counterattack, and why would you let Brazil counterattack if you didn't have to? It's Bobby Martinez. Yeah.
All right, I think that is a good summation of the hard side of the bracket. We will be back later on the subscription side, where we will do the easy side of the bracket, and we will break down the sort of rose petal covered path to the finals that somebody or other is going to have.
Yep, someone's got to come home. Could be the football. Got to go to patreon.com/doublepivot to find out what we think. All right.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.